From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Grolot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz and I discussed President Obama's recent trip to India and this week's elections in Greece that saw huge left-wing parliamentary gains and a new coalition government.
And he's making a lot of promises that we're not sure he's going to be able to keep, about 300,000 new jobs he's promising. We'll see if he can actually come through on those.
Then I'm joined by University of New Hampshire historian Nicoletta Gulacsi. Her work traces how changing gender roles at the turn of the century evolved into Rosie the Riveter.
The so-called new woman took up tennis, mountain climbing, and all kinds of women's athletics. This created a more physically fit type of woman who was then able to step into those roles.
The relationship between war, gender, and citizenship, right after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. Rebecca Cruz, let's look first at President Obama's visit to India this week. This is the second time he has visited India during his presidency. He referred this time to the fact that India and the United States can be the best of partners. Clearly, there are a lot of opportunities here. There was this long-term nuclear deal for civilian nuclear technology that they're still working on. But there are a lot of things that divide the two countries, too. Can you give us some context here and tell us why is President Obama visiting India a second time during his presidency?
Well, there's much discussion that he's actually setting a precedent here. It wasn't very common in the past for U.S. presidents to spend a lot of time in India, but obviously it's a growing economy, and obviously we have a lot of concerns there. Economically, yes, but the issues that they were talking about this time have to deal with nuclear issues, with the environment, and perhaps with some defense collaboration. So some interesting topics there. What's also been interesting is the media relating to this. This is the second time Obama has gone there, but this is the first time he's been there with the new prime minister, Mr. Modi, who was also in D.C. just this past fall. And the two of them met at a conference in Malaysia here a couple of months ago as well. So they've spent a lot of time together.
They like each other.
They do. We're calling this a bromance, apparently. And they're being called in the Indian media, at least, as Mobama. So they've talked a great deal about their relationship, how they feel that they can collaborate. But at the same time, they haven't necessarily hit very hard on some of these issues that do continue to divide us. In this trip, for example, they didn't talk much about Kashmir, didn't talk about Pakistan and some of those other concerns that we do have.
President Obama, of course, did raise the issue of climate change, saying that we cannot deal with the issue of climate change if India isn't on board. And of course, this really sensitive issue about the safety of women on the streets in India, that women should be able to walk to work and walk home from work and you know, enjoy the public just like anybody else without fear of attack, rape, murder.
Yeah, he did point that out. It's probably as far as a president can go on a state visit. You have to be very careful, obviously, in what you say. But he did point that out for sure. And also dealing with minority rights, religious minority groups in India and how they're treated.
The comments about women clearly coming from the very high profile cases in the past months and years. Well, let's switch very quickly to Greece. Greece has been in the news off and on, obviously, for its poor economic performance, its poor economic conditions over the past few years. But they just elected a new prime minister this year, a very leftist prime minister, Alexis Tsipras. He's very young, very good-looking, very different background than most prime ministers of his sort, and certainly in Greece. And this election was largely driven by those that are experiencing unemployment and all of the difficulties from the austerity measures from the European bailout. Horrible economic conditions still in Greece. So tell us a little bit about what's going on there and how this particular person might help them.
Well, we'll see how he can help them, but certainly the bailout has been so far unsuccessful. As you mentioned, really poor economic numbers. The bailout was supposed to ease the Greek economy, that they were going to pay back some of their debtors by creating taxes and austerity measures, as you mentioned, but this has been highly unsuccessful. And some of those cuts have been really, really deep. Education, for example, has seen dramatic cuts, and that obviously affects the citizenry and then affects their ability to spend. So there's been a real significant change here, and not for the better. And we're starting to see people respond to this. They're feeling it very firmly in their pocketbooks. Unemployment is skyrocketing. It was always high. It was high in 2010 when austerity first became part of the discussion, and 2008, of course, with the economic crisis. But now we're talking about 25% for the general population and about 50%, even a little bit more, for youth. So that correlation perhaps between cuts in education funding and then youth not being able to find jobs.
Well, the new prime minister is demanding that there be some debt cancellation and from the European Union. So this is something very controversial and of great concern. And of course, the Greeks' future in the European Union is at question.
Yeah, and he's making a lot of promises that we're not sure he's going to be able to keep, about 300,000 new jobs he's promising, 300,000 households that he will be providing electricity to, new taxes that he will eliminate. So lots of promises. We'll see if he can actually come through on those. But certainly the people in Greece are hoping that he can and are very excited about this change.
All right. Thanks so much, Rebecca, for being here as always.
Thank you.
If you have any questions or comments about this discussion, let us know on our website, kgou.org. While you're there, you can also listen to all of our past shows and read our digital content. You can also interact with us on Facebook and Twitter at Worldviews KGOU, at Suzette Corlett, and at Cruz226. In just a minute, I'm joined by University of New Hampshire historian Nicoletta Gulacsi for a discussion of the changing role of women during the biggest wars of the 20th century. I'm Suzette Gourlat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gourlat. My guest this half hour is Nicoletta Gulacsi, a historian at the University of New Hampshire who teaches courses on the British Empire and 20th century Europe. Her research focuses on the history of women in modern Britain, and she's the author of the book, The Blood of Our Sons, Men, Women, and the Renegotiation of British Citizenship During the Great War. Nicoletta Gulacsi, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you very much.
Nicoletta, you have focused your work on the First World War from a perspective of citizenship, and in particular how gender emerged as an important concept after the Second World War, particularly given women's suffrage and all the things that followed. So can you just start by giving us some sense of what it was about that Great War experience that kind of heightened this notion of gender and the role that particularly women played during the war and after the war?
Yes, indeed. I think we tend to think of war as something that really affirms traditional gender stereotypes. Men go off to war, women stay home and support the war effort. And certainly in August 1914, when the Great War broke out, that's what people thought would happen. In fact, women suffragists declared a truce with the government, and they agreed to stop acts of militancy and their campaign for the vote and to instead focus on the war effort. So people thought that the impact of World War I would be very traditional. What ended up happening, though, was that the demands of World War I were so great and the manpower demands were so tremendous that all of this began to break down. First of all, soldiers were going to the front in the hundreds of thousands. In 1916, they had to institute conscription, so even more men went to the front. And in that vacuum, all sorts of women filled their roles. One of the things people don't realize, I think, about World War I is suffragists were heavily involved in the effort to put women in jobs in munitions factories. And a suffrage organization organized many, many women's hospital units that actually put women in the line of fire as ambulance drivers, doctors, and nurses at the front. So all this really enhanced women's claim to citizenship.
Well, so many of us, when we think of our history, we think that this happened during the Second World War, right? That there was Rosie the Riveter and all of those women that went into the workforce because men were obviously off fighting war. But you're saying that this happened before, obviously during the First World War, but before that, maybe? I mean, was there something unique about the First World War that changed this dynamic?
That's an excellent question. I think we tend to think of women's heavy involvement in military action as being something that's part of the total wars of the 20th century. But in fact, women were involved in warfare well before the 20th century or the two world wars. Traditionally, women had been camp followers. In early modern Europe, a camp follower were women who followed the troops, often prostitutes, wives, girlfriends, and often just villagers who felt unprotected when the men left for war. And they followed the camp and provided many, very important functions. They did things like dig latrines, bandage soldiers after battle, cook. They even followed the troops in the American Revolution. George Washington famously hated camp followers, but they were very essential to performing all kinds of service activity on the battlefield, particularly after the battle.
it was in the mid-19th century during the Crimean War that women's participation in military action became respectable when Florence Nightingale professionalized military nursing. And she cleaned up the hospitals in the Crimean War. And after that, female nurses became a very important and established part of European militaries and eventually American military as well. What happens that's different in the 20th century is women become involved in wars in even more powerful ways. They become involved in making munitions, like Rosie the Riveter, as you said, in World War II, and the famous munitions girls of World War I. They did things like driving ambulances. And women's suffrage organizations in World War I became very involved in actually putting forward women who were going to be part of these military actions as ambulance drivers, hospital directors, doctors, and such. The reason I think the 20th century is so different is because of major changes in women's roles in the late 19th century. The late 19th century, women started not only demanding women's suffrage, but also really altering the way they were expected to behave. There was a dress reform movement that called for looser corseting. And think how constrained you would be if you were forced to try and do work with a whalebone corset that pulled your waist down to sort of 15 or 16 inches. Victorian women were fainting all the time. But the looser corseting allowed more freedom of movement. And in the late 19th century, the so-called new woman took up things like tennis, mountain climbing, and all kinds of women's athletics. So I think this created a more physically fit, able type of woman who was then able to step into those roles during World War I.
That's Nicoletta Gulacsi, a historian at the University of New Hampshire. Her book, The Blood of Our Sons, looks at men, women, and British citizenship during the First World War. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzette Gorelott, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorelott, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. My guest is Nicoletta Gulacsi, who studies the history of women in 19th and 20th century Europe. When we left off, she described some of the changing gender roles in Victorian England that led to women's suffrage and increased participation in wartime activities. So let's just step back, though, for a second, because often when we study women and war, we tend to sometimes emphasize the ways in which women are victimized in war and the ways in which women, you know, experience extreme negative impact from war. And they obviously do around the world. You know, we know that women, children, men too, but you know, non-combatants, civilians, largely women and children, suffer significantly from the effects of war. But what I'm hearing you saying is that there's also something that's been extremely empowering about the female experience, women's experience during war, at least starting in the late 19th century and into the 20th century, and that it enabled them perhaps to move forward certain issues regarding women's rights. Is this another take that we can perhaps learn, or something that we can take away from the experience?
Yes, and I think you bring up a very important point, which is, of course, the issue of victimhood for women versus empowerment. And I think that really depends on what country, what places, what regions you're looking at. The German army in August 1914 invaded and occupied Belgium. And many, many Belgian civilians, including women and children, were displaced, lost their homes. They got all the way into northern France. And many people were killed, hurt, raped, and such. So they were the sort of the quintessential victims of war. So there were definitely important female victims and very negative impacts on women. What happens in places like Britain and the United States, which are outside of the main action of the fighting, is that women's role in support work does end up being empowering. Women are able to step into jobs, for instance, in heavy industry that they had their eyes on for a long time. These were better paid jobs. These were jobs that involved skills. These were jobs that people previously thought women were incapable of doing. So in that way, there was an empowerment. But I think the question of empowerment versus victimhood depends very much on the geographical location of the women involved. And of course, remember that women in Britain and America also experienced tremendous grief. All those mothers who lost those boys, those sons, those husbands, those young men. And this ends up being the lasting memory, I think, of World War I, and one that we tend to see in the centenary commemoration more than anything else.
Well, so you've written about how these war experiences in this empowering way have led to changes in citizenship, in concept, the concept of you know, women and their role in society. So how is it that citizenship was affected? I mean, we know that society was affected. You've outlined all the various ways in which female roles in society changed, gender roles and expectations. But when it comes to citizenship, is it just about the vote, or is there something more to it than that?
I think that for women suffragists in 1914, they believed that they would never be fully citizens until they had the parliamentary vote, until they could vote in national elections. And this is something that they saw as the key to citizenship, even though they had other disabilities as well in terms of what they were and were not allowed to do. One of the things that I argue in my own research is interesting about this period for the forging of citizenship is that one of the arguments against women's suffrage in the period before World War I was the idea that only men serve in the armed forces and therefore only men should vote. And the rationale for that was that Parliament, the great legislative body in Great Britain, makes laws. And laws are backed up by physical force. Because men serve in the army and men serve in the police forces, only men should be making those laws. Women at this time could vote in local elections. They could vote for poor law guardians and school board members and things like that. But they could not vote in national elections where domestic and foreign policy was made. World War I kind of throws this into disarray. First of all, many soldiers were actually not able to vote when they were at the front because they weren't resident in their local areas anymore. So that all of a sudden undercuts that argument. Men who stayed at home but did not serve in the armed forces could vote. So there was an irony there. And then finally, women showed themselves to be far more essential in waging war than anyone had thought before. So when issues of citizenship come up during the First World War, they initially come up as a proposal to re-enfranchise soldiers who had lost their votes when they shipped out. But it turned into a much broader discussion. And at the same time that women, eventually women over 30, were enfranchised, conscientious objectors who refused to go to war were disenfranchised. And I think that helps show us how in Britain this willingness to patriotically serve the war effort became the litmus test of citizenship right at a moment when the vote was being debated. And very similar arguments are being made by American women suffragists during the war, and they will eventually get the vote shortly afterwards.
So that movement toward suffrage, did it come along with growing roles of just civic responsibility in the community in general and access to even running for office or being engaged in politics in ways other than just voting? That's the first step, right? But what other kinds of civic responsibilities did women pick up in the wake of that?
Women would have argued that they participated all the time in civic responsibilities. They raised money. They worked as auxiliaries to the Conservative Party or the Liberal Party or the Labor Party even before they had the vote. But women did labor under some very important disabilities in terms of citizenship. The one that they were focused on was the vote, but they could not run for high political office. And this one they really hated, but if they got married, they would assume the nationality of their husband. There were very heart-wrenching cases of British women who had married Germans, had lived happily, and maybe the German husband had died. And then during World War I, they were subject to being treated as enemy aliens because their nationality had been changed. all of these things were being contested by women at this time. With the passage of women's suffrage, women also earned the right to stand for parliament. And several female candidates stood for parliament in the elections of 1918. Only one was elected, and she was an Irish nationalist who turned down that opportunity in favor of serving on the Dáil in Ireland. But it's interesting that the cracking of the boat did begin to open up and change things in other ways. So women gradually became fuller and fuller citizens over the course of the 20s and the 30s.
Well, finally, Nicoletta, I have to ask kind of how this brings us to today in terms of female participation in politics and the role of women in civic activities and as global citizens today. I mean, you've talked about how, depending on where you were, what your geography was, how important that was. But where are we today in terms of, you know, how far have we come in these 100 years that have passed since the First World War in terms of women's rights and around the world?
Well, I guess looking particularly at the Western democracies, what I would argue is that what the experiences of the two world wars showed, and this is my opinion, my interpretation. Others would disagree with me, I think. But before the war, women contested citizenship by offering alternatives to male citizenship. Men were too belligerent. Women offered peace. Women offered a gentle alternative. Women would protect girls and women. The two world wars showed that the way women would achieve rights is by showing that they could participate in these national issues like war as effectively as men could. I think we see in the primacy of women in the Conservative Party, we think of Margaret Thatcher in Britain, Sarah Palin in the United States, that actually this role of women pointing out the conservative and the patriotic possibilities of women and womanhood has actually been more empowering in some ways for women than the radical challenge to patriarchy that was embodied in the pre-war women's suffrage movement. So I think these two world wars perhaps helped integrate women into citizenship, but perhaps created a more traditional idea of female citizenship that we still subscribe to in the Democratic West. Not always, but often.
Well, definitely more questions that we can have about this issue, and we'll be seeing where it goes. Well, thank you so much, Nicoletta, for joining us today and sharing your perspective on this important and interesting topic. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Nicoletta Gulacsi, a historian at the University of New Hampshire. We have information about her book, The Blood of Our Sons, Men, Women, and the Renegotiation of British Citizenship During the Great War, on our website. Worldviews is a production of KGOU and the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Sam Dupre wrote the web version of this story for KGOU.org. Our research fellow is Symphony Swift, and Brian Hardzinski produces the show. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Wurlott.